From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about the explosions in London. My guests are Van Romero. He's Vice President for Research and Economic Development and a Professor of Physics at New Mexico Tech. That's in Socorro. And Jimmy Oxley is a Professor of Chemistry at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston, Rhode Island. I'm just wondering, you know, we keep hearing the term plastic explosives. Professor Oxley, can you tell me what we mean by that?
Yes. Most military explosives, as they're made, like RDX or PETN, HMX, are white powders that aren't shapeable. TNT is an exception. You can melt cast it. But these other military explosives have to be shapeable, so you plasticize them. So you might use, for example, in C4, you might use 9% of a plasticizer so that your RDX can be shaped.
I got it. Okay, let's take a call now. Why don't we go to G in San Francisco, California. G, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello there. Thanks for getting me on.
Sure.
I just had a question about for Professor Romero. I wondered what kind of things can you tell from the material that was involved in an explosion? Let's just say if you have like a fuel explosion versus a high explosive type of detonation. If you to study the material, what kind of information can you gain from that, and what kind of different contrast would you see in those two different kind of explosions?
Gee, thanks for that, Professor Romero.
Sure. One of the things that we see in these military types of explosives that you've been talking about is that they have a very high peak pressure and have a, what I'll call a very strong punching power. They can punch a hole very easily through metal or through a building. Other slower burning explosives like ammonium nitrate or some sort of a fuel mixture don't have as much peak power, but they have a longer impulse. The pressure exists for a longer period of time, so there's more heaving involved. We use ammonium nitrate in the mining industry to heave overburden off of the ore. So we don't want to throw the rocks across the county. We just want to get them off the ore so that we can come in and mine the ore that's left behind. So slower burning explosives push, but they don't push as hard, but they push for a longer period of time, whereas the military explosives have a very high peak pressure. And so we look for evidence of that at the scene of a bombing, whether there's the type of structural damage that has occurred. Is it indicative of heaving or just a high peak pressure? In addition to that, we have done some work recently in some materials area of looking at what types of crystalline structure may change, say in a pipe bomb or other material that surrounds the explosives. That high shockwave that goes to it does have some effect on the crystalline structure that is in the material after the passage of the shockwave. So there's some very detailed analysis that can be done as well.
Okay, gee, thanks for that call. Let's try Michael in St. Louis, Missouri. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question was, earlier one of your guests mentioned a mass spectral analysis that could be done to find out what chemicals involved were here. And I was curious to find out how long would that take, and once they have got that information, exactly where does that lead them? I mean, well, how much can be gleaned from that?
Okay. Michael, thanks very much for that call. Jimmy Oxley, maybe you can answer that question.
Well, the mass spectral analysis is extremely good for the military explosives, and so the ID will be prompt. The unfortunate part is you've got to find the residue. So you have this huge scene of chaos where residue is being collected and brought to the lab. And in the Irish campaign, the lab, which is the forensic explosive lab at Fort Halstead, rather guaranteed a 48-hour turnaround. But now you've got four attacks, so I'm not sure if they can stay with their 48-hour turnaround with all this debris coming in, where you have to go through that debris, select the pieces that you're going to look for mass spectral analysis, because you're going to have to select the right areas. So as you can imagine, there's tons of debris coming in.
Yeah, I can see that. All right, thanks for that answer. Let's try Laura in San Antonio. Laura, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. My question is that often when you see photos of people that have been killed by a bomb, I know generally the shrapnel or fire or some kind of debris is what kills them, but sometimes they look relatively untouched, and I was wondering, what is it about the bomb that can kill you and leave you unmarked?
That's an interesting question. Jimmy Oxley, maybe you can try that?
Yes. The debris is certainly your largest danger, but for people who are extremely close, the shockwave itself can kill you. And that's probably what you're seeing in those cases.
Okay. Thanks for that. Let's turn to Ian in Los Altos, California. Ian, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. I had a question about getting rid of these bombs before they're a problem. I know that in a regular microwave, the microwave oven heats just the water in the microwave, and then that heats everything else. And I'm wondering if you could use some other frequency of microwaves to heat these nitrogen compounds that seem to be common to all these explosives. And, you know, maybe you could give it like a very high power for a very short period of time and then detonate the bomb, you know, remotely. So before the person enters the crowded subway or whatever, when they're in an area maybe that would be a good place for this to happen, you could hit them with a little burst and it wouldn't bother normal people, but if you're carrying explosives, they'd go off.
Interesting. Professor Romero, what do you think about that idea?
Well, the first thing is you have to detect it first.
Yeah.
That's a tough problem. There are some ways to try and initiate or render the initiator unusable as well. So there are techniques to disable a bomb, and certainly bomb squads employ those quite often when if they find a device, IED, unexploded device, they go in and very carefully and meticulously go through that process. Now, quite often, that takes some time. It's not something you can do, you know, just point the ray gun at it and shoot it. You have to be very meticulous and be very wary of the fact that if you do detonate the charge in question, there's going to be a shockwave that travels around. And so being able to isolate it is really the big part of the problem.
Okay, interesting. I wonder if I could ask you, Professor Oxley, can you tell anything about who made the bomb by what it's made of?
That's tough to do. Generally, there's three types of materials that you're contemplating: a military explosive, a commercial explosive, or an improvised. And so it might be a matter of access. In Madrid, we were told that there were stolen commercial explosives. Al-Qaeda has certain types of materials they typically use in improvised explosives, but they're very opportunistic in terms of what's available. And in Great Britain has fairly stringent controls, so they're definitely going to be investigating that avenue, as once they've identified the material, how could it be accessed?
Mm-hmm. And Professor Romero, I just wonder, it seems to me I read once upon a time that manufacturers were talking about putting tags on certain chemicals, chemical tags that would tell you more specifically where they came from so they could be traced in some way?
Sure, there is a possibility of putting tags into materials. One issue with that, though, is that there's so many things that are come from the mining industry, particularly when you talk about metals. And so the possibility of having, if you have a tagged explosive that was used in the mining process, that metal could have one of those tags in it and, you know, be a structural component. Then a bomb be placed next to it, and you could have more than one taggant sitting by. Now, I'm not saying that taggants are necessarily a good or bad idea. I'm just saying that there are things that you have to consider when you start tagging explosives. If you can get a very unique tag for some explosives and could trace it to its origin, that would be a much needed clue to trying to find out how terrorists got a hold of these devices.
Yeah. Well, it's a skill. It's sorry that the world needs a skill to be able to do this sort of thing, but I guess in the state of things, we do need to track these things down. So there you are. I'm afraid all the time, that's all the time we have for this segment of the show. I'd like to thank my guests. Van Romero is Vice President for Research and Economic Development and a professor of physics at New Mexico Tech. Thanks for being with us. And Jimmy
thank
Oxley
you.
Is a professor of chemistry at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston, Rhode Island. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you both, and we'll be back in just a moment.